We are glad to make all of our JCast Network podcasts free for our listeners. However, they are not free to produce and host. Please consider making a donation to JCast Network to help support our work by visiting jcastnetwork.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We have a great show for you today. In this week, in this half hour of the show, we will be featuring a best of. We have Elizabeth Reinicke, wrote a book, Chasing Portraits, chasing down the whereabouts of the almost 800 portraits and pictures, depictions of the shtetl life of her great-grandfather that were painted in Poland. Unbelievable. We've got lots of different types of music for you all throughout the show. The portion of the week is the portion of Vayera. We're still in the life of Abraham. This is Genesis chapter 18 for those who are following along. We have an unbelievable Hasidic story all the way at the end. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Sixty-seven Palestinians were arrested for stealing close to 40 tons of grapes and tomatoes from Israeli greenhouses near Gaza and selling the produce to markets in the Palestinian Authority. That's quite an operation. The Jerusalem Planning Committee approved permits for 176 housing units in a Jewish neighborhood of Nof Zion in predominantly Arab East Jerusalem. The expansion will create the largest Jewish enclave in a Palestinian neighborhood in the city. There are currently 91 housing units in the neighborhood of Jabal Makaber. 130 Israeli companies and 60 international corporations received letters from the current UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Jordan's Prince Zayed bin Ra'ad, Zayed al-Hussein, that's quite a name, warning them that they are being blacklisted for activity contrary to international law and UN decisions. All the companies operate in Judea and Samaria or the Jordan Valley. The Israeli government will deport thousands of illegal immigrants who entered Israel over the past decade. As part of the plan, illegal immigrants, most of whom came from Eritrea, Somalia, and Sudan, will be given $3,500 cash. There are around 50,000 illegal immigrants living in Israel. The governor of Maryland signed an executive order that prohibits state agencies from entering into contracts with companies that boycott Israel. Maryland is the 28th state to institute anti-BDS policies. And finally, let's hear it for fairness. The International Judo Federation called on the United Arab Emirates to treat Israeli athletes equally during this week's Grand Slam tournament. The UAE wanted to prevent the Israeli team from wearing the Israeli flag on their uniforms or playing Hatikva from the winner's podium. Let's hear it for the IJF. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have online Elizabeth Reinecke, who's written a book and a documentary, Chasing Portraits, A Great Granddaughter's Quest for her Lost Art Legacy. How are you today, Elizabeth? I don't hear anything. Whoops. Is Elizabeth
Hello?
There? Oh, yes, now. It helps, yeah. helps to push the right button. Here we go. Okay, so thank you so much for coming on. We gave as an introduction to this show, my wife, Hannah, who is the arts and culture correspondent for the Jewish Hour, came across this story and said, this is a must, and I even got excited about it. So this is, I was just thinking on the way over and preparing some of the things I was going to say, and it occurred to me that the only thing that I have from my grandparents from Poland, and I don't even have it, my uncle has it, is a teapot. You have within your possession many paintings that your great-grandfather painted in Warsaw and were brought to America. And this is just like, when I was thinking about this, wow, that is so awesome. So to have what you, to say that you have what you have, and then this whole pursuit of what else. So let's get some backstory about it. Tell us about your great-grandfather, please, Elizabeth.
Sure. So my great-grandfather, Moshe Renecki, as you say in Polish, or Reinecki as we say now, was a Warsaw-based artist in the interwar year period, so the 1920s and 30s. And he painted scenes of Polish Jewish life in the 1920s and 30s and documented everyday life. So men playing chess, scenes from inside the synagogue, Talmudic study, women in the park playing with children. So he was an ethnographer of sorts and a chronicler of life in Poland, you know, well before the Holocaust and well before Hitler's time. And in the early days of the Second World War, he became concerned about his body of work. And so he decided to divide it up into bundles. It's believed there were close to 800 paintings and sculptures in the years leading up to September 1939. And he divided the paintings into these bundles and hid them with friends in and around the city of Warsaw with the idea that when the war was over, he would return and collect the bundles and the collection would be whole once again. And unfortunately, that's not what happened. He eventually ended up inside the Warsaw Ghetto and was deported, we believe, to Majdanek, and he perished. But some of my family survived, my dad and his parents and my great-grandmother, and they managed to collect a small fragment of the original body of work. And so we have that portion that they were able to collect. My Grandpa George always said it was a miracle that survived. And as you said, it's those objects and those links to the past that are really very profound.
Indeed. Let's talk a little bit about, I can imagine, Poland in the 1920s, your great-great-grandfather probably wasn't very thrilled that your great-grandfather was engaged in art, was he?
Indeed. You know, I know little about him. My understanding is that his name was Abraham, and that he was a tailor of some regard in Siedlce, which is just outside of Warsaw, and that he sewed uniforms for the military and also dabbled in real estate. And when Moshe was a young boy, he was just drawn to drawing and painting and the arts, and his father was not very pleased, both because of the prohibition against making art, of course, but also from a very practical standpoint of how the heck was his son going to make a living selling paintings. Much a concern that many parents today have. And so he decided that he would marry Moshe off, and that that would be the end of it, and he would be married and have a family, and he would have to get a real job. And ultimately, the woman that he was married to, Perla, they owned together an art supply store. And Perla managed the store and took care of it, which freed Moshe up to go out into the world and paint, which he did. And he also exhibited, and he was, from documents that I've been able to dig up, it's amazing these documents survived, but was an active member of the organizations that promoted Jewish artists in Warsaw, and he exhibited and sold some pieces, and she made that happen for him.
Mm-hmm. And having an art supply store, if you're an artist, really comes in handy, I guess.
I think so. It was a clever purchase.
Indeed. Okay, so now, war-torn Warsaw. I mean, we use it as a generic term. When you say something looks like a disaster, you say it looks like post-war Warsaw. It's there was havoc and destruction. How is it that any of those 800 paintings were able to make it out of Warsaw or survive intact at all, Elizabeth?
Right. It's so true. So my understanding is that Warsaw was about somewhere between 80 and 90% destroyed. The package that Perla discovered was hidden in the Praga district, which is across the Wisła River in Warsaw. And Praga was less damaged than Warsaw, the main part of the city itself. And that was the package they recovered, and they assumed everything else had been destroyed, which made a lot of sense given all the bombings and fires and purposeful destruction of buildings. But what we've discovered is that more paintings survived, some of which we have some sense of a story of how they survived, but lots of nagging questions about the details, and others we just have no idea. So the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw today has 52 of my great-grandfather's pieces. And they bought various pieces over the years, and other pieces were donated. And how the people that brought them to the Jewish Historical Institute obtained them is really unknown. And so that's a big mystery. There's another small bundle of paintings that was saved by a farmer somewhere between Russia, Polish border, and Łódź. And we're not entirely clear how he obtained them, but they were eventually sold to Polish Jews who had been partisan fighters in Russia, and so that family today has some of those paintings.
Okay,
all these different pieces.
This is all very fascinating. So you were raised. Did you know your great grandmother? Did you ever meet her?
No, she died after I was born, and she actually knew about my birth, but she did briefly live in the United States. She moved to Le Mans, France, after being in the U.S. for a short period of time, and so I never met her.
Okay, but the painting, you grew up with your great-grandfather's paintings.
I did. So between my parents' home and my grandparents' home, there were a significant number of paintings on display, and they were just part of my childhood. They were there, and, you know, when you're a kid, you don't necessarily ask the right questions and know what it is that you're looking at. But the wonderful thing about that, on the other hand, is that I came to understand the paintings on my own terms, and they were just part of my everyday life, which is really an incredible thing that today I'm very grateful for.
Mm-hmm. So like you were like 10, 11 years old, your friends would come over and they'd say, hey, what's the story with all these paintings you got? And you'd say, oh, those are just my great-grandfather's. That type
of
thing?
Well, pretty much. Yeah. You know, it's funny, when your parents have things, you assume that they've always been there and will always be there, and you don't really ask those questions. So I don't remember a lot of conversations with my school friends, but I do remember them, and I always think of the people in the painting sort of as these characters, and I have a certain fondness for certain people in certain paintings because over the years they just really grown on me, and you know, some people have photographs and we have the paintings. And so the people in the paintings really sort of whisper across the decades and help us to remember a people and a community and a time and a place that, of course, was destroyed by the Holocaust. And so I feel really fortunate to know the people in the paintings. And while the paintings can't speak, we can speak for them and try to remember that history and to share it with others. And for that, I feel both an incredible burden and an incredible honored obligation to do so.
Okay, if you're just joining us, our guest today is Elizabeth Reinecke, who has written a book and documentary, Chasing Portraits, A Great-Granddaughter's Quest for Her Lost Art Legacy. So at what point, you got this stuff going, it's just like part of the wallpaper, and at what point did you begin, quote-unquote, chasing portraits then, Elizabeth?
So that has been sort of this multi-decade journey. My grandpa George died in 1992, and when he passed away, we discovered that he had been working on a memoir that we did not know about. And in the memoir, he talked about life in Poland before the war, and a lot of memories about family events and his father's passion for painting. And when we discovered that memoir, there was one passage in particular that really spoke to me. And it said, I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, it said something like, I'm writing this memoir if for no other reason than for my granddaughter Elizabeth to know the truth and to not be afraid of it.
Wow.
And yeah, I still I get chills every time I think about it. And that was this incredible moment where I thought, okay, I am not a survivor and I cannot bear witness, but I feel this incredible obligation to tell my family's story. And in graduate school, a number of years after that, I wrote my master's thesis about children of Holocaust survivors. I was really interested in Art Spiegelman's mouse books and tried to understand how children of survivors could have a voice within Holocaust discourse, even though they weren't survivors. And then I had this moment where I realized that the paintings were something I could do something about. And in the late 90s, we decided to build a website to showcase my great-grandfather's paintings. And it was shortly after building the website that we were contacted by Yad Vashem, the museum, of course, the Holocaust History Museum in Israel, with a request to donate a painting to them, which we eventually did. And it really clicked for me then that these paintings weren't just things in my house, that they were socially and historically incredibly important. And I decided that I wanted to advocate for them. And so I would say those series of things set me off on this journey. And then when we discovered that other paintings had survived, that really clicked the whole Chasing Portraits project into place. And I started to make the documentary film, and funding became incredibly difficult. So I thought, forget the film, I'll write the book. And then once the book became, it picked up a publisher, then people were more willing to fund the film. And so the book is done and out and available, and the film is in post-production, and we're really close to we're close to the finish line. I'm hoping to be in film festivals perhaps by the end of the year or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, people know about the Woman in Gold, the Edith Bloch bar, which painted by Scheele, and the whole thing that went with that. And that was like a whole big thing. That was like one painting and the big fight that had to happen with it. And the whole thing over there is that's our painting and I want it back. And understandable for what the owner of it sold that painting for, I can understand. What's your motivation, Elizabeth Reinecke, in pursuing your grandfather's paintings?
I love that question, because although my story is certainly parallel to the Blochbauer painting, there are definite differences. And one of the big differences for me is that my great-grandfather actually painted the painting, and that it's art from Poland and documents the Jewish community. So all those things intertwined make it a little different. My goal is to restore my great-grandfather's legacy and to share the art with others. And so I have been, early on in this process, I spoke to some attorneys and I said, that's our art and we should get it back. And they said, well, that's all nice, but here's what you need to prove that. And here's how long, you know, this process can take and how expensive it might be to pay for attorney time and provenance researcher's time. And you have to understand that every single painting is a different case. You can't just sit and lump them all together and have that be a singular case. And so at some juncture, I said, well, you know what? What if we don't pursue this as an issue of restitution and return? And instead, I pursue it as a historian. In other words, I try to find all the paintings. I try to let people know, the people that have the paintings, to know that I won't come and fight them for the paintings. And so they will perhaps be more willing to open their doors and let me in. I'd like to create a catalogue raisonné, in other words, a document that documents everything we know about my great-grandfather's art, both those paintings that we have found and have and the ones that are missing. In other words, we have photographs of paintings, but we don't know if they survived the war and if so, where they are. And so my efforts really have been more as an art historian and to try to better share the story. And so that's what I've been working on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So would you say that this is an art for art's sake or grandfather for great-grandfather's sake?
Probably all of the above. It's a very emotional thing that I just feel passionate about because, frankly, if I don't do it, I don't think anybody else would. And I think that that the story is profound and important. You know, I think photographs of the Jewish community, particularly in Eastern Europe before the war, are incredible. So, of course, Roman Vishniak's photographs are very well known, but there are other photographers whose work survived the war and is incredibly powerful. But the thing with a photograph is that it is of a particular person, and when you look at the photograph, you see that person. The thing that's profound about my great-grandfather's paintings is that other children of survivors and the Jewish community in general, when they look at those paintings, they see in it a sense of life and a sense of community and people. And there is a connection that I think doesn't always happen in a photograph. And so that brings me great joy to be able to share that and to be able to discover more pieces that tell us more about a community that is gone. And so I have this passion and persistence and perseverance about it and not always entirely sure where it comes from, but I feel like it's really important. I feel like a lot of times when we think about Polish Jewish history, we just think about the Holocaust. And I think it's really important to remember what came before and that there was a thriving Jewish community. And that there were a lot of artists, and not only my great-grandfather, and their work deserves to be known and taught in art history classes and Jewish education classes and in all sorts of different ways that bring a more rounded understanding of Polish Jewish history.
That is fascinating. I'm just like totally and completely blown away. So it was estimated that your grandfather painted 800 paintings. What percent of the paintings would you say have you been able to track down in these last two decades, Elizabeth?
So my family has about 120 pieces. And then the next largest collection that we know of is at the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw, which has 52. And then there are different collectors, private collectors, in Poland, Israel, Canada, and the U.S. Some of those we have seen, but not all of them. And so, you know, it's still a small percentage. I think that there's something like 600 or so paintings that I'm still, in theory, looking for. Of course, I will never find them all, and I will never know precisely what's out there, just because clearly so much was lost in the war, and I just hope that more pieces keep turning up.
Mm-hmm. How is that success going? I understand dealing with, say, like a person who's a Polish national, whatever, has some of the paintings, and you call them up and say, listen, I think you have some of my great-grandfather's paintings. Their reaction, I could imagine, is not so great. I mean, why didn't my aunt went back to Poland? She was raised. My grandmother was not a survivor. She came out in, after World War I. And there was always letters going back and forth to the shtetl. So she knew of the address of her grandparents' house in this shtetl. So she went to Poland. Mm. She went to this place. She knocked on the door. And she said, my grandfather used to live here. And the person slammed the door in her face and never opened the door again. So have you been getting door slams? Or are people like saying, oh, you're an art historian, and of course this is for the better of mankind, or something in the middle, or neither, or both?
Well, both. There have been some people who have been incredibly kind and said, come to my home, come see the paintings, bring your film crew, take photographs, and they have been delightful part of the conversation. Some people have been hesitant at first and then let me in, and there have been other people who have said no. And all of those are in the book, for sure. I think that it's complicated, and that is why I've tried to emphasize that I am a historian. But I do think that, you know, history is both complicated and an emotional thing for people, and yeah, it's hard. I can't speak for everyone, you know, their own decisions about how they pursue these things. I will say that if somebody has one of my great-grandfather's paintings, first, I would love to come see it. And the second thing is that if they don't want it or they're unable to care for it, I would be delighted to have it gifted to our family. So I'm always eager to see more art. But the pursuit of fighting for it, there's enough fighting in the world, and I would like to have it be less about who has it and more about what it portrays and how it tells us more about my great-grandfather's body of work and Polish Jewish art history and the Polish Jewish community. To me, those underlying questions are more important, and you know, I don't want to fight. That's exhausting in a different way. And so I've tried to make it a more friendly, positive experience for everyone.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, would you say chasing portraits of your great-grandfather's legacy, is it a hobby, advocation, compulsion, addiction, obsession?
Yes, all of the above. I don't earn a living from it. It is definitely a hobby that has taken over my life. I feel incredibly thrilled to have finished the book. That was wonderful. I'm really excited to be narrowing in on finishing the film. And then I do need to take a breather. It has taken up several decades of my life, and I am hopeful that the story does continue and that I find more paintings, but there will, at least at this juncture, not be a second documentary and not a second film. I would love for someday to have an exhibit, you know, New York, Chicago, Detroit, LA, San Francisco. You know, it'd be great to be able to showcase the paintings at some of the Jewish art museums across the U.S. I think there definitely is interest in it. So maybe that would be the next project. But I do need to take a breather, just because it's really an all-consuming project.
Mm-hmm. Art? Do you have art shows planned? Anything in the hopper?
We do not. You know, it's been really an eye-opening experience. The Holocaust museums tell me it's fine art, and they don't do fine art. And the Jewish museums tell me it's a Holocaust story, and they don't do the Holocaust. And so I have been left in a strange no man's land, and it's part why I chose to write the book and make the film.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. The style of art, looking at the pictures that you have in the book, remind me of another artist whose first name, his last name was Tammuz. I'm thinking it was Mordechai Tammuz, or I'm not exactly sure. I don't remember his name. And we came across him accidentally at an exhibit in the Jewish Museum in New York. And it was very, very much the similar type of thing. It was shtetl scenes that he painted. I actually had the author on. He passed away 2 months after I interviewed him at like 95.
Oh my God.
And his stuff, I'm just trying to remember what his first name was, but he also, his kids did a website. So it seems like there would be a need for such displays of your work. How are your kids handling this advocation, Elizabeth?
My kids and my husband are incredibly supportive. I have had to travel for the project, and they just, you know, nothing but support. They've been fabulous. My kids definitely know the story. My youngest son has started to read the book and ask me questions, and that's important. I'm really proud that he's interested and wants to know more. And my older son was involved in some of the shooting of the footage and is actually in a small scene in the movie, which is a pretty profound moment that to me really is about passing legacy on between generations. And so, you know, at some juncture, they'll have to figure out what role the story plays in their own lives. And all I can do is pass on the history and my pride in my great-grandfather's artwork as best as possible, and hope that they make wise decisions about what they do with it.
Okay, wonderful. Our guest today has been Elizabeth Reinecke, written a book called Chasing Portraits, A Great-Granddaughter's Quest for Her Lost Art Legacy. You mentioned that the documentary is in final stages. Do you have a release date?
We do not, but I certainly will post it on my blog and my social media feed and also my newsletter. So if anybody wants to follow in any of those places, we'll always love to have more supporters come along for the ride and to be kept abreast of what's happening.
Okay, that is so awesome. I hope you keep us posted. I just liked your Chasing Portraits Facebook page and sent you a friend request on Facebook, so we can keep in touch. And I look forward to further developments of Chasing Portraits. Thank you so much, Elizabeth Reinecke, for coming on and sharing your story.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay, take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Schulfenman, here you are listening to The Jewish Hour. I find that incredibly inspirational that someone has taken upon themselves to do such a thing, not just for their own, but for like the benefit of mankind, making the world a better place. And that's really what it's all about. Speaking of making the world a better place, this next song coming up is by Mordechai Shapiro. It's called Biyachad, and it's a extolling the praises to an organization we had on the show, I don't know, maybe 2-3 years ago, the representatives of the Detroit chapter of Yachad, which is a national, maybe even international organization at this point, which helps people with special needs. So let's listen to Mordechai Shapiro, and the song is Biyachad All Together.
I like to draw and paint. I like to wake up late, but I don't like to clean my room. I like when mommy bakes the challah and the cake. Sometimes I get to lick a spoon.
I can get up and stand if someone holds my hand, then I can walk along my way. I like to talk to you, and when you listen to whatever I have got to say, we can all sing, we can all sing, we can all sing, biyachad, yachad. We're creating biyachad. It's a special harmony. We can all sing, we can all sing. Family, sometimes I'd rather be alone, away from everything. I like to be with friends and to connect with them. I like to feel that I belong. We aren't quite the same, but really that's okay. I know that we can get along. We can all sing, we can all sing, we can all. I'm really brave, sometimes I feel afraid, and I don't always toe the line. Sometimes I fall and then I get back up again. Nobody's perfect all the time. I like when people see the good I have in me. We all can give it our own way,
giving our own way.
Let's spread the love around. Our differences don't count. Let's make the world.
Want assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale. Herschel Finman, here you are, listening to the Jewish Hour. Up next, this is the Freilichs, and this play piece we're going to be called is Klezmer Dance. Let's get right to it.
Thank you.
Some things are better the way they used to be, like the crisp feel of a cool autumn day, the serenity of a baby sleeping, or the feeling of coming home after a long trip. Franklin Cider Mills makes cider the way cider is supposed to be. Its old-fashioned, clear, crisp taste reminds you of a cool autumn day. Located in the heart of historic Franklin Village at 14 Mile and Franklin Road, Franklin Cider Mill has been making cider the same way for over a century. Always fresh, with no additives or preservatives. You just can't buy Franklin Cider in any supermarket. Franklin Cider Mill is open from Labor Day weekend to after Thanksgiving from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Come visit Franklin Cider Mill. It's kind of like coming home.
Herr Schulzman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. You probably notice a pattern after 21 years of me doing this that I usually play three songs in the middle of the show. The first one is usually something very modern, just recently released. The second one is generally a klezmer tune or something that's sort of like Yiddishist type stuff. And the third one is a variant. So that's, you know, it's all different types of stuff that we play. So this variant this week, this is Yeshiva Boys Choir. And the song that they're singing is Tov LaHashem. It's Let's Sing Good to God. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurances accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Herr Schultzman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. This week, as we said in the introduction to the show, is the portion of Vayera. It is in chapter 18 of the book of Genesis and follows. Starts out, we're still dealing with Abraham. Abraham last week got circumcised and is sitting at, the portion opens up, and Abraham is sitting at his tent talking to God, who has come to visit him. And why is the Almighty visiting Abraham? It's because Abraham is sick, and it's really a good thing to go visit people when they're sick, to make them feel better, to cheer them up. That is, of course, if they are well enough to be cheered up. So here it is. Abraham wasn't necessarily just sick. He was just recuperating from a, what we would call today, a procedure. It's an interesting thing. Abraham starts complaining to the Almighty. What's he complaining about? It's hot. It's even hotter than L.A., the first game of the World Series. It is blasting hot. And as such, there are no guests. People aren't traveling. Abraham, if you recall, was the proprietor of Honest Abe and Sarah's truck stop and camel wash. You know, this is he had a he was running an oasis in the middle of a desert and a crossroads. This is in Beersheba, which was right in the middle between the roads between Europe and Asia and Africa and Central Asia as well. So everybody went through Beersheba, especially when they knew that there was such this wonderful rest stop, Abe and Sarah's, Avram and Sarah's place. And it was there that Avraham did his thing. What was Avraham's thing? Avraham's thing was not running a rest stop. Avraham's thing was promulgating godliness. And people would come to him. They would say, thank you so much. How much do I owe you? And he would say to them, don't worry about it. It's on the house. All you got to do is recognize that there's one God in the world. And this is how Avraham developed the following of thousands of people. Says we have to do similar things like that as well. You find yourself at work. There's no reason why you can't talk to somebody just in a nice way without missionizing or proselytizing or that type of stuff. Just a nice conversation. Do something good for somebody. Become a living example of what a good monotheist is. And encourage people, again, to be good people. We've got to take a quick commercial break. The time is fleeting. Don't go away. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard. The Specs Howard School of Media Arts is proud to have been a sponsor of The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding comes from its sponsors, listeners like you help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. That's 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Your help is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Herr Schulfinman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Go to rabbifinman.com. You'll find on the contact pages, you'll find a way to do it. You have a song you want to hear? We have a request ready for next week, and we'll take care of that, God willing. Sam, thanks for tuning in. We also have archived editions of the show right here. You'll have, we find there, archived editions of the E-Parsha, U-Parsha, Hasidic Story, classes, all things in which we try to convey Judaism in an entertaining and educational way. You'll also find the very important donation page. Jewish Hour has been on the air 21 and a half years now, only through listener help like yours. Go today, go to rabbifinman.com, go to the donations page, find a number that you like, enter your own number, do it today. Don't like credit card giving? Understood. Drop your donation of any amount to The Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48237. And while you're at it, you can check out the Jewish Ferndale webpage or Jewish Ferndale Facebook page as well. The story takes place. There was a certain Rabbi Chaim who was a very wealthy person, and he would visit the Tzemach Tzedek, the Third Lubavitcher Rebbe, 1850s, on occasion. So one time he went, and the Rebbe asked him, "Who's your wagon driver?" So he said, "This is Yeshayala, the wagon driver." He said, "Next time you come to Lubavitch, make sure you bring Shayala. So, okay, and let me know beforehand when you're coming." He says, "Okay, fine." So a couple of weeks went by, and he had to go back to the Rebbe. So he sent word ahead that he's going to be at this certain day, and he's going to be having Yeshaya as the wagon driver. So he came and he told the Rebbe, "I have done what the Rebbe wants. I have come back, and I have brought Shaya, the wagon driver." So the Tzemach Tzedek was very happy. He said, "Go tell Shaya that I want to see him." So he went and he told the wagon driver, "The rabbi wants to see you." He said, "I have no business with the rabbi. What do I know? I'm just a wagon driver." He said, "Listen, if you don't go see the rabbi, you can go home now, and I'll go find somebody else to take me back." That meant that he would have lost most of the money for doing this Uber service back then, as we would call it. So he said, "Okay." So the rabbi said to him, he went to visit the Tzemach Tzedek, and the Tzemach Tzedek asked him to come to a dinner that night. Very unusual that they should have a festive meal in the middle of the week. So he left, and they asked, he went out and they told him what happened. And they said, "What did you do?" And he said, "I have no idea what I did." He says, "What could I do?" He says, "Listen, I'm just a wagon driver, but my wagon driving takes me to places that are far out, not near any place. And if there's it happens that there are people that are so distant and isolated that they have a kid and there's nobody there to circumcise the baby," as it was in last week's portion that we opened up with this week's portion. "So I learned how to do it. So it once happened that I was driving and I came to a place and there was a woman who had just had a baby and her husband was deathly ill. He couldn't get out of bed and it was the eighth day and they needed me to do the circumcision, to do the bris. But it demands you have to find somebody to hold the baby. So I went out, I looked, and finally I saw a Jew with a white beard. And I said to the Jew, 'Please, could you hold the baby? Could you be the sandik?' Didn't say a word, just walked into the house. And I'm talking to the guy, he's not saying a word to me. We do the bris, and then the guy, the old man, finally says, 'You have to have a meal. Everybody has to have a meal at a wedding, at a bris. It's part of the deal. You have to have a meal.' He said, 'Well, I told him I have some bread and some cheese.' He said, 'Go get it.' So we sat down, we had bread and cheese, and he said, 'The father of the son is not here.' I said, 'Are you crazy? He can't get out of bed.' I said, 'What are you talking about?' The old man went over to the bed, pulled the guy out of bed, and as soon as the guy stood up, he was healthy. They sat down, they ate. As they're walking out, so he wanted to thank the guy, ask him about him, but the guy disappeared. That night they had the meal with the rabbi. And after Yeshaya, the wagon driver, left, one of the rabbi's sons said, 'What's so special about this wagon driver?' And he said, 'Anybody who has a meal with the patriarch Abraham, and they eat even out of the same plate, shouldn't I take the opportunity to eat with him?'" That's going to do it. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you have a great week. We hope you had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope that we see you again, back again next week, the same time. Take care.